Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the current economic stagnation a long but ultimately temporary shift, or is it our first introduction to the way of the future? Although they disagree on the shape of a recovery, many economists predict the U.S. and global economies will eventually return to levels of growth comparable to what they've experienced in the past. But my guest today is convinced that gross domestic products will not and cannot return to their previous reliable levels of expansion, given the 21st century realities of resource depletion, environmental degradation, and debt. So what will we experience in a future so economically unlike the past? Richard Heinberg is a peak oil educator and senior fellow of Post-Carbon Institute. His new book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Richard, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's very good to be with you.
So discussions of this possibility began in earnest nearly 40 years ago with this famous report published by scholars at MIT. What's different about the situation now that makes this a more urgent issue?
Well, 40 years ago, they were tracking trends in population growth, resource consumption and depletion, and environmental impacts. And their base case scenario tended to show a peak in industrial output around the first and second decades of the 21st century. So they were looking at a situation that might or might not develop in a few decades. Now we're looking at those sorts of developments in real time. We're seeing the increase in oil prices over the past few years and leveling off in actual oil production. We're seeing the fossil fuel industry in general having to go after lower and lower quality resources using more expensive technology. We're seeing records broken every year with regard to the costs to society of environmental crises, weather impacts, droughts, floods, and also industrial accidents like the horrific accident in the Gulf of Mexico last year. So what was being discussed more or less theoretically back in 1972 in The Limits to Growth, which was the best-selling environmental book ever published and, of course, was immediately attacked by mainstream economists, what was theoretical back then we're actually seeing play out right now.
So, you know, economists still talk about a U-shaped or a V-shaped recovery or something that looks like a sort of a check mark. You're looking at an L-shaped future where we've dropped and we will stay where we are. That idea terrifies people. Is that why they don't want to talk about it?
Well, yes. I mean, most economists and I think virtually all politicians are more or less cheerleaders for the economy because we have an economy that runs on confidence. If people are confident that the economy is doing well and recovering and prospects are good, then they go out and spend, and that causes the economy to do well.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if someone says, well, you know, maybe the future looks a bit dark, then people start to pull back and consume less, save more, which is the rational thing to do, but then that actually causes the economy to contract. So, of course, not many people want to go out there and say that our prospects for growth are not good. And the only reason I'm doing it is that I believe that this is really important and we have to change our behavior and change some fundamental aspects of our economy and adapt because otherwise I think we're going to hit the wall.
And you're saying we're going to stop growing whether we plan for it or not. And it's like we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, from a purely financial standpoint, I think the indicators are really strong, and many economists have discussed these things. The fact that we have an aging population that's moving from the phase of life where they're, you know, buying houses and consuming stuff to a phase of life where they're sort of pulling back, not working as much, saving more, spending less. The fact that house values have fallen so much in recent years and are continuing to fall, so household net worth is way down, and that's a drag on consumer spending. And, of course, the persistent high rate of unemployment. All of these things are portents for an economy that's not likely to rebound anytime soon.
So if we're not going to grow, is 9% unemployment or thereabouts in this country what we ought to get used to?
Well, not necessarily. It depends on how we choose to respond. If we leave it up to the market, I believe that that's likely to be the case. We will have very high unemployment. We need to restructure our economy in some, as I said earlier, some fundamental ways. Moving away from dependence on fossil fuels, that means relocalizing a lot of our economic activity, particularly our food system. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of opportunities there for people to contribute. So if we were to organize this transition, this economic transition properly, I think, in fact, everyone could be employed.
So, of course, the question comes down to, do you have government policy largely setting the architecture for this, or is it about individual decisions? But it remains, in 2011, I would think, political suicide for a politician of either party to say, I don't think we're going to grow, we need to get used to it, and here's how we're going to sort of ease into that reality.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. And therefore, at least for the foreseeable future, I think this is going to be mostly a matter of families and communities doing what they feel they need to in order to respond to these changing conditions. And in the book, I do describe some things that the folks can do. But again, they're all in the direction of pulling back from consumption, paying down debt, and becoming more self-sufficient, growing more of our own food, and so on. And these are exactly the kinds of things that do not lead to economic expansion.
We should be clear, if it hasn't already been obvious from our conversation, you don't believe it's impossible to thrive without growth.
That's right, yes. I mean, this whole period of economic growth that we've known over the past few decades is a historic anomaly. We lived without growth for thousands of years. Empires rose and fell, but in real terms, per capita GDP has grown far more in the last century than in many of the last centuries put together. And, of course, that's been mostly due to the availability of cheap, concentrated fossil fuels that have enabled us to make more stuff and distribute it around the world in ever larger quantities. That's what's really driven growth. Unfortunately, I think most economists have looked at this pattern and attributed it mostly to the market, the magic of the marketplace, when in fact it was just a matter of having a lot of cheap energy with which to do stuff.
Well, talk about this, Richard, because we've had a lot of economists on this show, and they are very smart men and women. What accounts for the blind spot with regard to resource depletion that you're writing about here?
Well, economic theory, again, has grown up during this anomalous period, and economists have underscored a few basic processes within the economy, like substitution and innovation, and attribute much of our economic growth to substitution, efficiency, innovation, factors like that. And of course, those are very real phenomena. And as we turn this economic corner, we'll be relying on efficiency and innovation and substitution all the time in order to adapt. But the usual assumption in economic theory is that if one resource gets scarce or expensive, well, then that the market will cause us to turn to another resource and substitute it. And they would point, for example, to the 19th century and how we were relying then on whale oil for illumination and lubrication. And as we were hunting whales almost to extinction, that made rock oil, what we today call petroleum, cheaper by comparison, and the result was the petroleum industry. Well, yeah, that was a great classic example of substitution, but, you know, how does that work today? You know, as oil gets more expensive, what are we supposed to turn to? We have ethanol and biodiesel, but as we've been seeing over the past few years, there are limits there. We're taking 40% of our national corn crop and turning it into ethanol, and that only supplies us with a pretty trivial amount of gasoline or fuel for our vehicles. So, yes, we could have electric cars, but again, that's going to take a considerable amount of time to make that transition, that substitution. There's nothing immediately ready on the horizon, so we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner.
A lot of folks talk about coal and natural gas being certainly not unlimited, but in vastly more plentiful supply, particularly in this country, than petroleum. What's your response to that?
Well, once again, we are chewing through the low-hanging fruit. It's not as though we're about to run out of any of these fuels.
Mm-hmm.
There's still lots of oil left in the Earth's crust and certainly lots of coal and natural gas. But as time goes on, we have to dig deeper and use more expensive technology to extract these things. My immediately previous book actually was on global coal supplies. I've also published in Nature on that subject. My conclusion from a pretty serious study of the subject is that we're going to see much higher coal prices over the years ahead, and largely because of China. China's using 3.5 times as much coal as the U.S. right now, about 3.5 billion tons of coal per year, and is starting to import coal from Australia and Indonesia. But the entire world export trade in coal only amounts to about 700 million tons, and China could absorb all of that with just 2 or 3 or 4 years of continued economic growth at the current pace. So that means China is going to be a big buyer of coal on the world stage, and U.S. coal producers will have every incentive to want to sell more of their coal to China, which will push up coal prices here domestically. So utility companies here in the United States, even though the U.S. is still self-sufficient in coal, are going to have a big competitor for the coal that they want to burn.
Does the fact that we have not yet refined renewable energy technologies, I'm talking about hydroelectric and geothermal and solar and wind, to the extent that they can replace a significant percentage of our fossil fuel needs, does that mean we never will get there to the place that we have as much energy as we need and now get from fossil fuel?
Well, that's a conclusion that we reached at Post Carbon Institute with a study we did a couple of years ago. We looked at 18 different energy sources, including several different kinds of solar and wind, geothermal, tidal, wave power, and so on. And we analyzed them across 10 criteria, including the energy that's returned on the energy that we invest in getting energy.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at the environmental impacts, the scalability, location of sources, and so on. We found a number of these alternative energy sources to be viable, and our conclusion was, given the declining availability of fossil fuels, we should be investing as a society in renewable energy sources. But each of them has drawbacks of one kind or another, including problems with scalability or problems with intermittency. And so we're never likely to have the kind of fast-paced consumer economy based on renewable energy that we've had with cheap fossil fuels.
Richard Heinberg is my guest. He's a peak oil educator and senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute. His new book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. We'd love for you to join this conversation, and you can do so by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Of course, you can always send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a peak oil educator and senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg. His newest book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Richard, you mentioned China before the break, and many people are aware that China is still growing, although some of that is becoming more erratic than it had been. But you don't see China as booming into the future indefinitely.
That's correct. And there are several reasons for that. We've talked about China's hunger for coal. And China's economy is overwhelmingly dependent on coal. 70% of its total energy comes from coal. Now, China is trying to change that by developing nuclear power and solar and wind as rapidly as possible. But these still make up a pretty tiny slice of China's energy pie. So for the foreseeable future, China is a coal economy, as is India. So that's an Achilles heel, because although China is almost self-sufficient in coal still, that's changing, and it's almost certain that China's ability to grow its coal production domestically will be challenged over the next even 2 or 3 years. Then, of course, China has a real estate bubble, China's banking system has some structural problems. So a lot of people are looking at the Chinese growth miracle more skeptically now than I think they were a couple of years ago.
So what does a no-growth world mean for the progress that has been made in places like China and India and elsewhere in the developing world for their efforts to try and elevate their citizens to at least a decent middle-class lifestyle?
Right. Well, where those efforts are built on the use of fossil fuels and the building of infrastructure to use fossil fuels, highways and cars and so on, that's a big problem. And it'll be a problem as much for us as it is for them. The whole project of development has really been, to a very large extent, a matter of encouraging people in less industrialized countries to adopt the kinds of technologies and economies that we have pioneered in the U.S. and Europe. And that may not be such a good thing. If we're going to pursue development in the future, it really makes sense to rethink the process of development and help less industrialized countries to leapfrog the fossil fuel era into the renewable energy era.
Do you imagine this will change global migration patterns?
Well, it could very well, and also not just because of changes in the economic status of nations, but also because of changes in global climate and also problems with water supply. We're seeing ecological conditions on the planet changing very rapidly, and it's highly likely that we will see migrations, particularly away from equatorial regions toward more temperate parts of the planet. I understand you're having a bit of a heat wave there in Texas.
Oh, golly, we sure are.
I would guess there are a few folks there who might be considering migrating to, who knows, Wisconsin or someplace like that. But, you know, it's one thing if this is a bad summer or a bad season, but when we start seeing these kinds of changes consistently year after year, with droughts in some places and floods in others, people often are forced to leave their homes. They don't do so easily or gladly, but we're likely to see more and more of that occurring.
Richard Heinberg is my guest. His new book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's turn on the phones now to Tony, calling from Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Chris. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Good. I wanted to make a quick comment. I haven't read any of your books, Mr. Heinberg, but I'd very much like to. I actually teach a course in environmental sustainability in the MLS program at SMU. One of the most important things I heard you mention was the concept of energy return on energy invested, which we talk about in energetics. and which is something that traditional economists need to start paying attention to. They need to start thinking about energy more like a currency than they do something which is just traded on the markets and the open exchange. So I appreciate your comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad you appreciated it, because it is a point that's very often missed. We often see from the renewable energy industry or various environmental organizations projections that we could replace all of our fossil fuels with renewable energy sources and still keep the economy growing the way we have in the past. And that would be nice if it were true, but the reality is most of the renewable energy sources have lower energy returns on the energy that we invest. But at the same time, fossil fuels are seeing rapidly declining energy returns on investment. For example, the shale gas, or sometimes called fracking gas, that we're getting from places like the Barnett Shale there in Texas. This is kind of an economic miracle, but it may be a fairly short-lived one, because the energy return on the energy that's invested in producing this stuff is actually quite low. In the early days of oil, a single barrel of oil's worth of energy invested in exploration and production could produce 100 barrels or more of energy at the end of the day. But with fracking gas, we're seeing energy return on energy investment in the low single digits. And to run a society on the basis of that kind of energy return means that most of society's effort and investment has to go into the energy sector in order to make it work. The only reason that's not true now is that we're subsidizing these low energy return fuels, low-grade fuels like tar sands and fracking gas. We're in effect, as a society, subsidizing those with high energy return sources like conventional imported oil and hydropower.
Do those subsidies get in the way of private investment into technologies which have been viewed as too expensive for the yield, things like solar and wind?
Right. Well, we tend to have perverse subsidies in our society. In some areas like agriculture, it probably would be best just to take away all agricultural subsidies and let the players sort it out among themselves. In the energy field, things are a bit different. We're going to have to plan ahead and invest ahead of time in whatever energy future we want to end up with, because this is a long-term project. We can't change our energy infrastructure overnight. And we found with corn-based ethanol, we poured a lot of treasure into that as a society, as a nation. And it's turning out not to have been a particularly good decision. So we can't afford to make many more wrong turns along the way. We have to come up with a real energy plan and policy as a nation that will take us into the middle decades of this century.
1-800-933-5372 is Think's telephone number. Let's go back on the phones now and speak with Frank in Sherman. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was in regards to governments and modes of production, specifically capitalism versus other types of government, and how that plays into the depletion of carbon pools, climate change, and whatnot. And I'd like to hear your views on about if there are any studies that relate that modes of, I guess, types of government back to the depletion of carbon pools.
Thanks for your call. Richard, what do you know about that?
Right. Well, I try to avoid using the word capitalism as much as possible, just because it seems to me that there's so many different definitions of the word floating around, and as soon as you use the word, people tend to make assumptions about where you're coming from.
As in, they would assume that you want to overthrow all capitalism and move
right,
to socialism?
They assume you must be a socialist.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, looking at different forms of government over the past few decades, virtually all of them were promoted growth economies, both capitalist, socialist, communist governments, and all of them suffered from problems of environmental degradation. So from the standpoint of the environment and long-term sustainability, I'm not sure there's that much difference. Now, of course, a lot of people would point to criteria like political freedoms and so on. There are a lot of factors that one can judge economies by. Here in the U.S., we have reached a situation now where our economic inequality is much higher than in most other industrialized nations, and it's higher, in fact, than we've seen since the era of the robber barons back in the late 19th century. And I think there's a legitimate discussion to be had as to the limits to social sustainability in the face of high economic inequality. And if, in fact, our economic pie is not going to be growing in the future, if, in fact, we're looking at a pie that stays the same size or even decreases in size, and some people are doing extremely well within that and other people are not doing well at all, that could undermine the social sustainability of the system. So that, I think that's something we really should be discussing as a nation.
We have an email here from Paul in Farmers Branch who wants to know what a no-growth economy would look like. How would the quality of life be affected?
Right. Well, of course, we've been advertised into thinking, over the course of the 20th century, our biggest problem was overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people could buy it. So we invented advertising and consumer credit to help soak up all of that overproduction. So part of the result of advertising is we developed a kind of consumer mentality quite deliberately in this country that said, well, you're better off if you consume more. You're going to be happier if you consume more. If you don't consume the right products, then you're an inferior person compared to somebody else who's consuming, higher class products and so on. Well, none of that's really making us all that happy over the long term. And in fact, that kind of consumer mentality, I think, eats away at our psychological health and integrity. So as we move toward a non-growing economy, there actually could be some benefits in reducing consumption and finding ways to do so that make us happier. A non-growing economy doesn't have to be a stagnant economy. I like to use the metaphor of an ecosystem. Most ecosystems run on sunlight, which is pretty constant. Of course, it changes from season to season and day and night. But year after year, about the same amount of sunlight is moving through the ecosystem. And yet ecosystems are always changing. Some organisms are evolving, displacing others. And I think a non-growing human economy would look basically the same. Some organizations, some companies, some producers would outcompete others. There would always be innovation and change. And yet the total amount of energy and materials moving through that economy would be fairly constant.
Would we have to change the way we prepared ourselves for the end of our working lives? In other words, most people are investing a lot of their money in the stock market to provide for their own retirement. If the markets weren't growing, would that option be gone?
Well, this is a problem with the economic model that we've created. We've created the expectation that people should be able to live on the interest from their savings and returns on their investments. That works in a growing economy. It's not going to work so well in an economy that's not growing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to find ways of reorganizing, how we rely on those sorts of expectations.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Shannon calling from Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All the indication, and I'm going to use a socialist approach, but I'm not a socialist. I'm a conservative religious person. But it seems to me, and looking at all the indication, we are at the end of so-called imperialist economy. All the indication shows that we're no longer a center of economy. And we have large competitors like China, India, and European Union. My question is like a 2-3-part question. First of all, is there any plan where we're going to go from here? Not 10 years from now, even 2 years from now. And also, it looks like we are entering an environment similar to prior to World War II. Is it a possibility that because of the scarcity of sources, we may end up going to war sometime in the future with China or India or even European society? And one more part of the question is, as the inequality is growing in our society, is it possible that that's going to help or that's going to push the rise of fascism in the society? And thank you. I'm going to take my answer afterward.
You've given us a lot to think about, but we'll start that answer now and maybe finish it after the break. But Richard, why don't you take a stab at Shannon's questions?
Yeah, it's hard to say if there's a plan somewhere in the halls of Washington as to, where we go from here. Certainly, I don't hear anything from the chattering class of politicians and pundits. Maybe, deep in the bowels of the CIA or NSA, there are people sitting around a table planning for, the real world that we're moving toward. I hope somebody is is taking these factors we've been talking about seriously. Are resource wars likely in the years ahead? Unfortunately, I think that is a possibility. Michael Clare writes a number of books on this subject. His most recent book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet.
Hmm.
And in that book, he discusses all the sort of resource flashpoints around the world. And there are quite a few of them. So I would take that possibility very seriously. And then would economic inequality possibly lead to fascism? That again, is a real possibility, unless we are willing as a society to face that economic inequality and discuss it rationally and do something about it.
Richard Heinberg is with us. He's a peak oil educator and senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute. His new book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard Heinberg, author of the new book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Richard, you talk in the book about the need, moving forward, to redefine progress. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, currently, we use GDP, Gross Domestic Product, as our measure of economic health. It's basically just how much money we're spending on an annual basis within the economy. And in effect, it ends up as a measure of consumption. So as we're consuming more, GDP goes up, everything looks rosy, everyone's happy. GDP numbers stall out or go down, everyone worries, chews their fingernails until the direction changes again. If I'm right, and by the way, I'm not alone in the conclusion I've reached in this book, but perhaps we could talk about that later. There are whole schools of economists and others who are reaching basically the same conclusion about the end of growth in the economy. But if we're right in saying this, then that means that we have to find something else to aim for as a society other than increasing consumption. In fact, critiques of GDP go at least all the way back to 1968 when Robert F. Kennedy made a famous speech, which you can find on YouTube, by the way.
Internet's miraculous.
He criticizes GNP at the time. If you want to search for it, you'll find it under RFK and GNP. But since that time, a number of other indicators have been proposed that are broader based, that take into account ecological integrity, the satisfaction of people with their lives, how peaceful the society is, and so on. One of the most intriguing was developed in the tiny Asian nation of Bhutan starting in the early 1970s, and it's called Gross National Happiness. And they've developed a broad-based indicator that looks at a whole range of social factors. And lo and behold, Bhutan has quite a low GDP. It's still a poor, largely agricultural country. But here we are in the year 2011, and people in Bhutan are generally happier than people in most other countries. They rank in international studies on contentment and happiness. They rank pretty much near the top. And that's because they've made that their priority, making people happy rather than making them rich. If it's not going to be possible for us to increase our GDP, we have to start aiming for what we can do that actually will serve us as a society and as human beings.
So talk about some of the people who are doing this. I'm interested in the transition towns and the common security clubs that you describe in the book.
Right. Yeah. Well, the transition towns are fascinating. This is a grassroots, ground up kind of phenomenon that from the ground up, I should say, the people aren't ground up. that's it emerged over, just over the past few years. It started in Great Britain, and people get together and they look at what positive is happening in their town, in their community. You know, almost every town has like a farmer's market or some kind of local food program, credit unions, local credit unions, maybe a ride share or car share program. And these are all kind of little isolated programs being run in the community. But all of them actually have a similar goal, which is to serve people's basic needs for food, transportation, health care, and all the rest, in a way that's more local and that relies less on a globalized fossil fuel-based economy. So what the transition towns do is encourage all these folks to get together and create something that ends up looking a lot less like a protest march than it does like a party. Because everybody tends to have a really good time in making all of this stuff happen and making it more prominent with the community. Typically, the transition initiatives have a great unleashing in a big community event where, you know, everyone is invited and all of these organizations are featured, and that sort of puts the transition town on the map. There are currently 400 or 500 transition towns around the world right now, and about 100 here in the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. You know, we're at 7 billion people, and we're probably heading for 10 before we flatten out. But it's almost just it's almost as if because Malthus was off and Lester Brown was a little wrong, we don't talk about overpopulation anymore. Futurists and greenies would rather, you know, they talk about growing meat in a petri dish or eating insects before really helping people throughout the world control their family size. And to me, this additional 30% of the population is going to have to factor into your concepts of growth. Could you tie those two things together?
Right. Well, I think you're absolutely right in bringing up the topic of population growth, because if the economic pie is not going to continue growing, then if population does continue to grow, that ensures that the average slice is going to be getting smaller and smaller. Whereas if we could control population size, if we could reduce fertility, then even with a stagnant size economy, we could ensure that everyone's slice would remain the same or even get larger. And it's really sad that this whole issue has become so politicized over the past few years. And in fact, many people think that even talking about politics is some kind of elitist sort of discussion, when in fact the people who lose the most from population growth are people in the poorest countries, in countries where people have are only able to afford basic necessities, food, water, and very, very basic shelter. If they have large families, that almost ensures that they'll be unable to educate their children, provide for some kind of capital formation, start a business, or anything like that. So they, large family size almost ensures that these people will remain in poverty for generations to come. It's in the countries like China that have engaged in very, unfortunately, in the case of China, coercive, but not in most other instances have not been coercive, but where they have engaged in fertility reduction measures, those countries have tended to see economic productivity as a result.
And we should say there are a lot of ways proven to work to help to reduce fertility rates that have nothing to do with coercion, including education of women.
Absolutely. And one of the fellows at our Post-Carbon Institute actually is a man named Bill Ryerson, whose other organization is called Population Media Center. And what they do is, in poor countries, hire local writers and actors and create radio soap operas that millions of people listen to all across the world, especially in the poorer countries with high population growth rates. And in these soap operas, which of course are written in the local languages and so on, the situations in the lives of the characters in the soap operas eventually turn on issues around female empowerment. And this actually has been shown to be the cheapest way of changing fertility rates in nations where this has been deployed and studied, cheaper even than providing free birth control.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Kelly in Dallas. Hey, Kelly.
Hi. There's a community in the Midwest that was absolutely flattened by a tornado a couple of years ago, and the name of it, unfortunately, escapes me, but the narrative I remember is that under the leadership of a couple of brothers that ran the local John Deere distributorship, the community decided to completely rebuild itself on as close to a zero carbon footprint as possible, and wound up making very local distributed power networks run off of windmills as the basis for their community energy. And I was wondering if Mr. Heinberg was familiar with that community, if he had been there, and if he had any comments on that community as a model for what we might do in the future.
Yeah, unfortunately, the name of the town isn't coming to mind, and I haven't been there. I am originally from the Midwest, so next time I'm back there, I should take some time and look that place up and see how they're doing. It does sound like a great success story. You know, clearly our economic future is with localization, distributed energy, and renewable energy. These may not give us the kind of consumer society that we're used to, but they are the path to the future. And so, you know, I think the folks in that town made a very far-sighted kind of decision in taking that path.
Of course, the thing the rest of us have to do is take existing systems that are not, you know, sort of raised and find ways to convert them.
That's right. And, you know, as the economy contracts, that's likely to take maybe some different kinds of paths than ones we were anticipating. For example, we could all have a much more efficient transport system, either if we all had electric cars or if every American city had a really robust public transit system with electric trolleys and train systems and so on. But, you know, that's not likely to happen anytime soon.
By the way,
electric cars are going to take a while. So the way people actually will respond to higher oil prices will probably have to do with just driving less and doubling up, you know, putting more people in vehicles with rideshare and car share programs.
By the way, that tornado was in Greensburg, Kansas, thanks to Jeff Whittington in the control room.
Thank you so much,
Greensburg,
Kansas. I'll be in Kansas in a few weeks.
All right, May 4th, 2007 was the date that all took place, so it's good to know that they're doing better these days. Maybe you can check it out and talk to us about it at some time in the future. I think we have time, Richard, to take one more call. Let's speak with Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hi. My question was, I was wondering if you thought it was possible to had a zero-growth economy with our current debt-based monetary system. Have you had any ideas about that? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Wow, what a great question. I deal with that quite a bit in the book, as a matter of fact. I think our current debt-based monetary system is going to be a real problem in a non-growing economy. Money, of course, is created when banks make loans, and of course we could be talking about the commercial bank on the corner or the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. That money really isn't based on anything in particular. There's no definition of the word dollar that the U.S. Treasury publishes. It's just the unit of currency of the United States, and that's it. So when money is loaned into existence, the interest that is going to ultimately be paid on that debt is not also loaned into existence at the same time. So the only way that interest can be paid is if the economy continues to grow and more loans are taken out by somebody else, and we all do business with one another, and then everything tends to work out fine. If the economy starts to contract or if growth stops, then suddenly a lot of bills come due, a lot of debts come due at once, and there's no new money to pay them off with. And that's what we saw starting to happen in 2008. So we really need a fundamental monetary reform if we're going to get through this this difficult crisis. And monetary theorists have been thinking about this problem for some time, and some of the best solutions tend to center on something called direct credit clearing. In other words, forms of currency that are non-debt-based, that are called into existence when we need them, when they disappear when we don't need them, and they're not necessarily run by banks. There are examples of community currencies all across the country that work this way. Also, the airline mileage systems, you know, when you fly, you get credit, and you can redeem that for future trips. That's kind of a direct credit clearing system as well. So there are lots of precedents for this, and we know it can work. But I think we also know that the current monetary system probably can't work in the kinds of economic conditions that are developing.
Is it important that we try to clear the vast amounts of debt we have as a country and also as individuals before we move forward?
Well, you know, that's individually, yes, I think that is a very good idea for folks to get out of debt as much as they can. For the system as a whole, it's a different story. You know, we are going to see almost inevitably some form of default as time goes on. There's no way that all of this debt can be repaid. And I'm not just talking about government debt, but debt all throughout society, from household debt to corporate debt and debt within the financial industry itself.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Richard Heinberg is a peak oil educator and senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute. His new book is called The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Richard, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.